Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
So I'm teaching again tonight. Adam will be back next week, I think. Hope. So we'll see. But just going to round out tonight what we've been talking about since I've been doing it. Still living in Kings a little bit. If y'all would turn to 1 Kings 21. So we're going to continue with some of our mic drop moments in Kings. And tonight rounds out that series. I feel like I couldn't do a class without spending about a third of it in Kings, because tonight rounds out what I would call kind of the third and final mic drop God drops on the story here, but it's really all connected, right? So I want us to look for a minute on a couple things we've done. We're going to talk about Jehu and Jezebel tonight a little bit. plenty of mic drops throughout what we've been talking about, keeping this whole area in mind. You know, just this story is chock full of so many cool moments, big moments. Again, remembering this is one of the loudest chapters, I would call. God is loud here. He's miraculous. Events are happening. Fire from heaven. Quiet moments with Elijah. Moments where God is literally moving pieces around the board of the politics of the earth, right? He's changing entire nations. God is loud, and he wants you to hear him, right? And in this area tonight, we're going to be looking at Jezreel and getting up here kind of in between what we've been looking at here. All these conflicts have happened over land, and we know up to this point, even through Ahab's success, a lot of problems with other invading countries. So we had sort of 1, 2, and 3, Elijah, Ahab, and then Jezebel as our big moments. And Elijah, we had his at Mount Carmel. We kind of talked about those big moments. Ahab versus Ben-Hadad, I talked about that last week, and that was his big battle with Hadad-Ezer, Ben-Hadad, same guy, with Syria and Damascus, all those battles that we can date. And I know I've shown a few artifacts here and there, but I just want us to remember that because it reminds us this is history. These aren't folk tales, right? This happened. We can tell. And that's so cool and important, too. I think that God, we have a record, right? But we have all these battles that have happened, and God's not done because he's systematically dismantling, right? All that the people have done. God says enough, right? Elijah starts it off. Ahab has some success, and then God tries to give him a victory. Ahab fails to give God the glory, so God takes it away, right? Ahab dies a cowardly, ignominious death. He dies as a coward while he's hiding in battle, and it doesn't turn out much better for Jezebel, we're going to see. She gets it worse. And I'm not trying to, I want to be clear, I'm not trying to celebrate violence. I hope it doesn't sound like I'm bloodthirsty up here, but, I want to point out that these are heady things. It's hard to talk about, but it's in the Bible. It happened. And violence, sometimes it's a lesson, too. God means what he says, okay? He doesn't negotiate, right? And I think we need to remember that, but he's also our God. It's scary and also awesome to me, right? It's scary in the sense of I want to be on the right side, right? I know exactly what my fate will be if I'm not on the right side. So what we see with that, after that, God says, okay, we're going to take care of Jezebel now, okay? But to do that, we get some more pieces on the board. So we have Jezebel doing a couple of things. I want to give it some more time talking about specifics. I mentioned the brief story of Naboth last week, kind of summarized it, but I want to go back there. We have a few things that she does to finally seal her fate, right? She does some things with Ahab and Naboth. She is defiant in her death in 2 Kings. We're going to jump there for most of the class. And we see Jehu, the avenger, okay, who has some problems of his own. All right, so somebody tell me, we've listed a few, but specifically, what were the sins of Jezebel? What are the things she has done so far, things that maybe we haven't talked about? What has Jezebel done? What comes to mind? Yeah, so we have that. She wanted to and then did put to death many prophets of God, okay? She went on her own genocidal spree well before Elijah took God's righteous executions to ground, right? So she executed the prophets of God. What else?
She wrote letters to accuse Naboth. It's interesting to me. 1% of the population was literate. And she's a queen. I know she's a king's daughter. So apparently she could read and write, wrote the letters.
That's important to point out. It is very important.
Did it for bad.
Yes, she did. And we yes, that's a good point. We see the powers of literacy wielded against people, right? But it's true. That's a good point. She does. We're going to look at that in a minute. She plays. This is some Game of Thrones stuff right here, right? I mean, it is. This is some. You could study the War of the Roses, the Tudors. I love all that stuff. Henry VIII. That stuff is nothing compared to what we read in Kings, right? That, you know, you know, it's bad. But we look at all this. This is some soap opera stuff, right? But what else did Jezebel do? So she manipulated. Yeah, she was the high priestess of. Her father was Ethbaal. The king, priest king of Tyre and Sidon. They had a theocracy, right? Worship Baal. She was a priestess queen. She had power. So she brought that worship to Israel, right? Yep, she did. She brought that in a way that had never been brought before. What else? Those are all good. Those are all most of the things I'm thinking of. Just a summary here of 1 Kings 16, 31, 33. We see her bringing in the worship of Ashtoreth and Baal, which we mentioned a lot. But that's important. God cannot stand this, right? It compromises his word, compromises his truth. God does not stand for compromise. We saw the Ashtoreth groves, the Asherah groves. That's her goddess, right? They believe that Jezebel, this is another reason why God couldn't let it stand, right? It doesn't matter if it's true or not. Let's not even get into that. We're getting into the people believe Jezebel is the living incarnation of the goddess Asherah. That's how it worked, okay? That was big. So we see... you know, early on, we see the marriage to Ahab. Jezebel brings that in, manipulates Ahab. Ahab is to blame, right? He's a coward. Ahab is to blame here. Jezebel plays her part. We see, you know, early on, we talked about how, you know, Ahab committed the sins of Jeroboam, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal of Sidonians, served Baal and worshipped him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal in Samaria, right? That's a big deal. That's new. We're not just hiding it anymore, right? Builds an actual temple in his holy city, the new holy city, in his eyes, after the kingdom splits. Ahab, again, sets up the Asherah poles, which were mentioned sort of phallic things that represented fertility. Sometimes they were trees. They represented something. It's not that God hated Arbor Day, okay? God was against what they represented, these fertility cults, very common in early civilizations, all right? These high places. One thing we kind of, again, we're not a full study of, but she instituted prostitute priests. Their rituals involved both men and women as prostitutes. When you went to confession, that was something else, right? Yeah, you didn't just go into bed. You know, that was their idea of they go to have these activities, and that's how they worship. It's very immoral. 1 Kings 21, we see, you know, Jezebel continually urging Ahab on. Just a few references here in 1 Kings 18. If you please read all this on your own. We don't have time for all of it, but 4:13 and 19 mention how she deliberately mounts a campaign against the prophets, as you mentioned, promoting Baal over Yahweh worship, or what we call Yahwism. Remember, what were the sins of Jeroboam? Go back to that. Why was that not good enough? What was it Jeroboam did?
All the sins of Nebat, but he was worse than that.
How so? Two calves, yeah. And if we look deeper at that, that has roots in Egypt, Hathor, all these fertility goddesses. It all goes back to the same thing. And the problem, remember, these were ciphers for God, right? It was trying to be, well, we'll worship God through this. We'll make the people happy, right? Constant compromise. There's a lot more to it. But that continued to happen. She also, if we remember, we read about before Elijah confronted Ahab, she invited all of her prophets to the royal table, right? All 400, they're in. They're not adjacent to, right? This is just rife with paganism. The veil is off. God's had enough. And in 1 Kings 21, we'll turn there and look at that a little closer. So this is the final event that Jezebel does to seal her fate. Does someone have verses 1 to 4, if you could read that for me? Chapter 21, 1 to 4.
Now Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard in Jezreel, beside the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. And after this, Ahab said to Naboth, "Give me your vineyard, that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it's near my house. And I will give you a better vineyard for it, or, if it seems good to you, I will give you its value in money." But Naboth said to Ahab, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." And Ahab went into his house vexed and sullen because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had said to him, for he said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers." He lay down on his bed, turned away his face, and would eat no food.
Boo hoo hoo. Okay. Once again, we see Ahab. He's sullen. He's the king, though, right? Why not just kill Naboth and take it? It's right next to Jezreel, his holy, his other palace. He's the king. He's already. Why not? Why is Naboth's vineyard a big deal? Two reasons, right? Why Ahab couldn't just take it, or could he? And why did Ahab want it so badly? I know it says he wanted to plant a vegetable garden here, but that's a lot. I'm calling a bluff here, right? There's a few reasons. That's silly, too. I think there's stuff we could talk about here with he's trying to get a good deal or something, but it's not where you... Why? What do you think? What are two big reasons he can't do this? Well, he's a weak person. That's true. It is funny, for all his talk and bluster, and he's in Samaria. He goes up to Jezreel, which is near where this is, near the valley of Jezreel. There's more to it, right? There's a scriptural reason, too, why it's a little iffy. What was it? Anybody remember that? When it came to land and how God said they could actually sell their land? Oh, yeah. We pages and pages of God lays out exactly the years of Jubilee and all this stuff. And we have, you can give it, that's a whole quarter. But there were rules to it and who could, who couldn't, and who could have it. So there's a couple reasons why, too. I could not find a better map than this. But one thing I want us to get an idea on Jezreel, this is just one scope. It's a valley, okay? It's a massive place. It backs up to the city of Jezreel, surrounded by mountains, but it's a massive plain, okay? And geographically, it's very important. We're talking about the area kind of right here. It's kind of in this whole area here. It has a nice, easy coastal route to Tyre, where, you know, Ms. Queen's home is, right? And King Ahab down here in Samaria. So there's a lot of military strength here as well. And again, I couldn't do a better job than this. Wish I could, but kind of just to show you, I know the topography's not great, but there's a lot of mountainous areas. Here's Mount Carmel. But look over here. There's a coastal plain, and it kind of goes through this massive valley connecting to the rest. If you wanted to own the trade routes, if you wanted to have a place to launch a military campaign against anybody in that Fertile Crescent area to Mesopotamia, you had to control it, okay? And Ahab didn't quite own it all because there was still sort of a veil of, well, you know, we are still sort of God's people. You know, he's kind of hanging on to these rules. And we see, again, it was a hard way geographically, something we don't often talk about much, but it was, again, the best way to get there. It was the only way to go if you're going to move a massive army or caravan to reach the sea, to get to Egypt, Asia, Africa. If you're going to maintain trade with the Phoenicians or Syria, you got to own that way. And we even see through history, I thought it was interesting, there's a lot of militarily secular history and biblical history. It's the site of several battles. If it sounds familiar, that's why. Just a few I listed: Saul and the Philistines and Samuel, Deborah and Barak's victory was at Mount Tabor, that's near the Jezreel Valley. Pharaoh Necho defeats Josiah. This is where Gideon defeats the Midianites, if you went to VBS this year. Gideon, that story happens in there. Napoleon versus the Ottomans. In real history, we look at, there were big battles. Napoleon loved there. There was a big battle there in the 18th century. The Crusaders went over and had a lot of battles in this big field. Megiddo is another name for that place. And a lot of people talk about that in Revelation. General George Allenby from Britain in World War I. There were a lot of battles. It's an important spot. Hope that makes it clear. It still is, okay, to this day. Very fertile. If you wanted to, again, have a military, that would be where you go. So if you look in Leviticus 25:23, that's where it mentions, and we don't have to necessarily go there for time's sake, but please, if you want to read on your own, this is where it mentions what Ronnie mentioned a second ago. Talks about the time they could sell it. The big thing about this verse is where God says, what does God say in this verse, if you remember, if you go there? Who does he say the land belongs to? Him. Right? And that's important. It is mine, but I'm giving it to you, right? And Naboth remembered this. So this was a big deal. Couldn't just give it up. So if we continue going back to 1 Kings 21, and let's pick up with verse 5. So now we get into the comment here. Liz has mentioned. So Ahab's boo-hooing and crying about this, right? Because he said, I can't just take it. He won't give it to me. Well, you know, see, he says in verse 6, because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite, right, and said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else, if it pleases you, I will give you another vineyard for it, right? I'll trade another one. Come on, give me this one. And he answered, I will not give you my vineyard. So, and there's, the last 9 years or so, I want to say about 9 years ago, they've discovered a lot of areas. You look at pictures where you can see where the vineyard was. You can kind of see where the presses were. And it's not just that place. He wants his land so he has access to the entire corridor. Because taxes, Naboth was making a lot of money on this. The king wanted all this. There's a whole lot of political stuff here. But continuing there in 6 and 7, Naboth refuses. And then Jezebel, his wife, says, "You now exercise authority over Israel. You're the king. Arise, eat food, let your heart be cheerful. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." And she wrote letters, back to what you said, in Ahab's name, sealed them with his seal, and sent the letters to the elders and the nobles who were dwelling in the city of Naboth. Right? And she wrote in the letters saying, "Proclaim a fast. Seat Naboth with high honor among the people. And seat two men who are scoundrels before him to bear witness against him, saying, 'You have blasphemed God and the king.' Then take him out and stone him. He may die." Why is Jezebel using Ahab's seal to do this? And in case there was any division, you remember something I showed you a few weeks ago? We know Jezebel had a seal. She had her own. She could have done this on her own. This is one of the seals of Jezebel that's been verified several times. We know it's Jezebel's royal seal. One of several they unearthed near the palace. It's a little broken, but it spells Yisbael, even in the words there. The letter has all the symbols that she would have for royalty. The scarab, the Egyptian imagery and Phoenician style, it all matches. The winged female sphinx representing power and royalty. Hathor goes back to the cow goddess and things like that, the goddess crown. A flail by a falcon, Ankh, the symbol of life, fertility, and royalty. This was rare, okay, for a queen to have this. She had her own, right? But Barry, to your point, this made it official, right? And I don't know about you, but just in case there was any question, if Jezebel does it, there might be some rioting, right? Maybe, because there's still a few that are like, well, I don't know. There's still a few dissents. But if the king does it, well, it's the king of Israel, right? So what we see happen there, for time's sake, in verse 11 to 16, what happens? If you can remember that, and read through this more later, she has them seated at the feast. The two scoundrels he puts next to him, they raise false charges against him, right? That's what this leads up to. They raise false charges. Hey, he blasphemes against God and the king. We should get rid of him. So the people bend easily, drag him out and kill him. Congratulations, Ahab. It's for sale now. Walk on in and take it. That doesn't go over well, right? Jezebel has Naboth killed. Elijah, we already went over this a couple weeks ago. He shows up to condemn Ahab in verse 18 and 19, but he also lays down the decree about Jezebel later as well. He comes and tells in verse 19:21, he says, you know, in the place where dogs lick the blood of Naboth, the dogs will lick your blood. That's when Ahab is killed in the battle and brought back to Samaria. And then jumping down to 23, Elijah goes on for a while, right? And he says, "And concerning Jezebel, the Lord spoke, saying, 'The God shall eat Jezebel, the dog shall eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel.'" So God is telling them exactly how she's going to die, right? So let's continue there. So to get there, God puts his other pawn in place, right? If we remember, when God talked to Elijah, he said, "Your time is up, right? You need to go appoint Elisha to be your prophet. Anoint Hazael to be king of Damascus," right? So and then he said, "I want you to anoint Jehu, the new king." Okay? So Elijah's gone out and anointed this guy. And this is where we see that happen. What we have now, after Ahab is defeated, he's got sons, right? Ahaziah and Joram. Ahab is defeated at the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead, which I covered last week. So Ahaziah becomes king. Now, he has a brief reign for about 2 years, I think. If you recall, he's the one who fell from a high place. And we don't have time for his whole story, but he falls from high place and sends his prophets out to ask for a prophet of Baal to heal him. The word gets out, and Elijah says, "Really? You can't even ask a prophet of God?" So Ahaziah dies, and Joram becomes king. Okay? So at this point in 2 Kings 1, we're in 2 Kings now, Joram is king. Jehu is a military commander for Joram, okay? Stay with me, I know there's a lot. He was the commander for Ahab, okay? We learn later that Jehu was present when Naboth's body was thrown out, right? When Naboth's vineyard was taken. This comes in later. Jehu's been around. He stood by and watched a lot of things happen. So if we go to 2 Kings 9, and we're going to spend the rest of our time here, for the most part. So 2 Kings 9, verse 1. So I'll read a little of this. And I want you to think about what is different about Jehu, how he becomes king, and how some of the other kings become king. So verse 1, chapter 9. And Elisha the prophet called one of the sons of the prophets and said to him, "Get yourself ready. Take this flask of oil in your hand and go to Ramoth-Gilead." So this is after the battle, right? Jehu's still there. "Now, when you arrive at that place, look for Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi." This is a different Jehoshaphat than the king of Judah, by the way. Just, that's kind of confusing. "But, and go in and make him rise up from among his associates and take him to the inner room. Then take the flask of oil and pour it on his head and say, 'Thus says the Lord, I have anointed you king over Israel.' Then open the door and flee and do not delay." So the young man, the servant of the prophet, went to Ramoth-Gilead. And when he arrived, there were the captains of the army sitting, and he said, "I have a message for you, commander." Jehu said, "For which one of us?" And he said, "For you, commander." Then he arose and went into the house, and he poured oil on his head and said to him, "Thus says the Lord of Israel, I have anointed you king over the people of the Lord over Israel. You shall strike down the house of Ahab, your master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab all the males in Israel, both bond and free. So I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam," here we go again, right, "the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah. The dog shall eat Jezebel on the plot of ground at Jezreel, and there shall be none to bury her." And he opened the door and fled. Jehu came out to the servants of his master, and one said to him, "Is all well? Why did this madman come to you?" And he said to him, "You know the man and his babble?" And they said, "No, it's a lie. Tell us now." So he said, "Thus and thus he spoke to me, saying, 'Thus says the Lord, I have anointed you king over Israel.' Then each man hastened to take his garment, put it under him on the top of the steps, blew his trumpets, and said, 'Jehu is king.'" All right, so they've anointed Jehu now. What is different? What do you notice? How is Jehu made king versus some of the other kings? For example, in chapter 3, verse 1, when Jehoram became king, it says, "Jehoram the son of Ahab became king over Israel in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat." But how is Jehu made king? What happens? Or what's Elisha do? Yeah, since I'm a prophet. Military commander, yeah, and he anoints him with oil. That's kind of what's interesting. So, yeah, okay, so wait, why did he take him back there? Why do it that way and not in front of him? Is there a reason? I don't know. What do you think? Some of this is a little speculation. Well, I'll say one thing. He's anointed, number one. So this is signifying, this is not just succession, right? God is hitting the reset button, right? He's anointing a king, just like in days of old. Samuel anoints a king. We have this anointing take place. And this is a new type of king. Just something to think about. He didn't reveal it yet. He told them after the fact. I think it speaks to Jehu's character, maybe. There's a few reasons we could speculate. But what happened, since we're on the mic drop moment, we're getting to Jehu doing this thing, right? So if you remember back in 1 Kings 19, 17, Elijah says, you know, like I just mentioned, he anoints all these people. And in 2 Kings 9, read verse 14 for me, someone. 2 Kings 9, verse 14. Yep. So that brings it full circle. So I just want us to see that coming too, right? All of God's pieces are coalescing, right? It's more like it's all constricting, right? Everything's coming together. And Hazael, I'd mentioned before, just a couple of things briefly, that, you know, we have evidence of him as well. Hazael, I think this is him. That's him here. Hazael. He's mentioned on the Shalmaneser. I've brought him up a few times because he comes in at the very end here. Shalmaneser, the Assyrian king, is constantly putting pressure on the region, right? Even Tyre is kind of afraid of him. It takes everything they have to fight this guy off. Hazael, we know from Scripture, we won't have time to read all that, but if you'll read 2 Kings 8, 7 to 15, when Elisha goes to anoint him, Hazael's a nobody in his words. He says, "Who am I?" And he anoints him, says, "You're going to be king." They wind up killing the king. Hazael becomes king. And he says, "I'm nobody. I'm a son of a nobody." And it's interesting. We actually have in the statues of his name made by Shalmaneser, his enemy, he only referred to Hazael as the usurper king, son of a nobody. So we see that in history too. It's really cool how we see Bible come alive there. But he was a usurper. But he. Yes. So we see that happen. And it's not necessarily a good thing for Israel, but it's God's way. Because Hazael is put in place to keep Israel in check. He's a help for a time, but not for long. So if we look at verse 14 to 16, you just read that about Hazael. We see how Jehu is going to accomplish this coup, as it were. So we have Jehu. Joram, the son of Ahab, is now defending Ramoth-Gilead, right, from Hazael. They just finished this battle years before against Ben-Hadad. Well, now we're back on the warpath again. But King Joram, verse 15, had returned to Jezreel to recover from the wounds which the Syrians had inflicted on him when he fought with Hazael, king of Syria. So Joram, Ahab's son, has been injured, and he returns to Jezreel. Samaria was the capital of Israel, but Jezreel was sort of a military palace slash Jezebel stronghold. And we have historical evidence of that too. Jezebel was holed up in the palace where the military stuff was. Okay? And we see Jehu, let's see, in verse 15 there, he goes back and he goes to Jezreel. Jehu said, "If you are so minded, let no one leave or escape from the city to go and tell it in Jezreel." Right? So Jehu rode in a chariot and went to Jezreel, for Joram was laid up there. So Jehu tells his subordinates, don't tell anybody. We don't want to give it away, but we're going to start the bloodbath now, right? I'm going to execute God's will because God told me to do it. Jehu gets right to it, right? So he begins his mad ride to the city. And if you'll remember in 1 Kings 19:17, Elijah, in his prophecy, just kind of remember, he says that everyone who escapes the sword of Hazael will die in some way or another, right? He says, your people are going to die. God is saying, you're not going to get out of this. Just like your father died against Ben-Hadad, you know, everything's happening according to his will. So Joram is his son, and he's running now from the battle. And just to kind of remind our who we are right now, this is how we got here, right? I know the names are confusing, but we have Ahab married Jezebel, and they had two sons, Ahaziah and Joram. Ahaziah is dead. Joram's the current king. Jehoshaphat of Judah has Jehoram, also named Joram, who marries Athaliah, the daughter of Jezebel, right? So we have a union that should not have happened anyway. And we have the sons Ahaziah and Joash. So that's who we're talking about here. We have Joram and Ahaziah as we continue. They're the guys at Jezreel as Jehu comes to get them. So in verse 17, so Jehu comes riding up to Jezreel where Ahaziah and Joram are hiding, right? Now a watchman stood on the tower in Jezreel and saw the company of Jehu as he came and said, I see a company of men. And Joram said, get a horseman and send him to meet them. Let him say, is it peace? So the horseman went to meet him and said, thus says the king, is it peace? And Jehu said, what have you to do with peace? Turn around and follow me. So the watchman reported, saying, the messenger went to them, but he's not coming back. Then he sent out a second horseman, said, is it peace? Jehu says, what have you to do with peace? Turn around and follow me. So the watchman reported, saying, he went up to them, he's not coming back, and the driving is like the driving of Jehu, the son of Nimshi, for he drives furiously. So he obviously was a mad driver, right? Jehu, he was kind of erratic when he drove. So what... Yeah, mind me. Okay, yours says that. What does this tell us about, if we take this interaction at face value, what does this tell us about Jehu's reputation amongst his men and amongst everybody else there? What do you take from it? Zealous? They jumped on Jehu's side pretty quickly too, right? These scouts, they get behind him and ride with him. Notice that? I mean, I think they know what's happening here. I think it tells us a little about Jehu's character. So in verse 21 to 26, we see the rest of the line begin to fall. In verse 21, we see Joram said, make ready, and his chariot was made ready. The Joram king of Israel and Ahaziah king of Judah went out, unified. each in their chariot, and they went to see Jehu on the property of Naboth the Jezreelite. And the poetry, the poetic justice happens here, right? We have, they come up and see Jehu, and you have to imagine, right? You know, here's the commander of their father. Why are you here from the battle? What's going on? Is it peace? And could someone read for me in verse 22, after it says, is it peace, Jehu? What does Jehu say? Read that for me, verse 22.
What peace can there be so long as the whorings and the sorceries of your mother Jezebel are so many?
Ooh, mic drop has been thrown, right? And that is when Joram, calling out Jezebel, and now Joram turns, we see in verse 23, he tells Ahaziah, treachery. Uh-oh, you know? They turn to go, and to summarize there in verse 24 and 26, we see Jehu's loyalties are to God. As Jehu draws his bow, shoots Joram between his arms, sank down in his chariot, and then Jehu in verse 25 tells his captain, pick him up and throw him into the tract of the field of Naboth the Jezreelite. For remember, when you and I were riding together behind Ahab his father, the Lord laid this burden on him. So we see the son get buried here, you know, just as Naboth was slain and Ahab as well. And in verse 26, as it continues, we see Jehu remembers the Lord and says, I will repay you in the plot, says the Lord, right? So we see him die. Ahaziah makes a run for it, but they both ultimately die. So then we get to Jezebel as we kind of round out the story. So Jehu has now killed the sons. He's going to Jezebel. Could someone read for me 2 Kings 9, verses 30 and 31, please? So that relief right there is one that was excavated near Samaria, several around the ruins of Samaria and Jezreel. These were statues and reliefs of Asherah, her goddess, right? They were everywhere to remind us of their beauty and things like that. What is different here about Jezebel's reaction versus how Ahab's sort of response in the face of death? What do you notice? What's different here about the two?
She's defiant.
She's defiant. Ahab was cowardly, compromising, chicken. At least Jezebel wasn't that, right? And I think Jezebel knows she's about to die. Maybe she's playing her last card, but I'll say this again. And this is something we have to remember, too. I think sometimes we think if we just trot Scripture out, and I mean, just like Elijah did, miracle happens and Jezebel looks and kill them all. I don't care. And I think we have to remember that because it's a lesson we have to take. We can't just count on, we have to stay true to what God says he's going to do and, not base it on what we perceive our actions to be and the outcome. We can expect people to hear the word and just like that turn, but that's not how it works. That's not our job either. Right, as Christians, we're here to be a light.
Why did she call him Zimri?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Let's see, that's back in, where is that? Yes. From what I understand about that, somebody may have to reflect, but what I could tell was that's the name of a traitor who had betrayed his master before. So there's a little lineage there. It gets into like a colloquial thing. It was kind of like calling you a Benedict Arnold, yeah. That's my understanding, and I may be wrong. That's the interpretation I've always had. So if somebody else has a different one, please tell me. But I think, she's defying him, too, saying, oh, here you go. And maybe she's hoping the people will turn, but they do not. In verse 32 to 37, we see the gruesome death of Jezebel. He looked up at the window and said, who is on my side? Who? Two or three eunuchs looked out at him, which is kind of ironic, honestly, based on Jezebel. She keeps around her. Then he said, throw her down. So they threw her down. And some of her blood spattered on the wall and on the horses, and he trampled her underfoot. And when he had gone in, he ate and drank. Then he said, go now, see to this accursed woman and bury her, for she was a king's daughter. So Jehu says, we'll give her a king's. But they went to bury her, but they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. That's disgusting, but it's brutal. That's an image, right? We're giving it for a reason. Therefore, they came back and told him, this is the word of the Lord, which he spoke by the servant Elijah, saying, on the plot of ground at Jezebel, dogs will eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the corpse of Jezebel shall be as refuse on the surface of the field in the plot at Jezreel, so they shall not say, here lies Jezebel. That's pretty thorough. Right? Why does she get such an indignant death? Is it important? What is symbolic here about her dying in this manner? And why is it important that they say she will not be recognized? What do you think?
It was revenge for the murder of Naboth.
That was a big part of it, yeah. Revenge for Naboth.
All the prophets.
All the prophets, yeah. And there's not much more you could do besides someone who is an adherent of beauty and that sort of thing. This is a very, and to not give her an actual burial, this violated all kinds of customs, okay? But she gets it in the end. Just on time's sake here, I just wanted to summarize some of this, but as we go through, we see the mic continue to fog. He's not done. Jezebel is dead, but now what, right? If you read verses 1 through 11, I encourage you to read chapter 10, verses 1 through 11 later, but the gist of it is he challenges the people once and for all. It's kind of like Elijah, we kind of remember. He challenges the people to choose, and he reaches out, it says, to the various nobles and servants, those taking care of Ahab's kin, and says, he tells them, you're going to have to make a choice. He tells them, take their heads, behead them, and bring them to me and lay them outside the gate in two piles, right? And they do, but for the most part. They go through, the whole chapter is Ahab, Jehu going on a killing spree, ordained by God, to go, and he kills everyone he encounters, right? He asks them all, who are you? He even deceives them and invites them back for a party at some point. He brings them all in, and we kind of already answered this question, so we'll move on. But if you notice the plot here in 2 Kings 10, verses 18 to 27, one thing he does that's similar to Jezebel, if you read, kind of take time to read through that whole passage, to get the last few prophets taken care of, Jehu uses his military tactics, right? He sends out a message and he says, hey, everybody who didn't hear, I'm the new guy in town. You thought Jezebel threw a party. I'm going to make it better. And he invites them all in, right? And he invites all of them. He even sets up he gives them robes. He puts up a whole fake Baal worship ceremony. Gets them all in, has his troops around the building, right? They all come in, lets them complete the ritual almost. And then Jehu says, nobody, if anybody leaves here, as a soldier, I'll kill you. And so they close in and kill every last prophet, right? Completely thorough.
He also made sure that there were no Lord worshipers there.
Any what? Lord worshipers?
Yeah.
Yes.
Any Yahweh worshipers.
Good. That's a key. Compromise was done, and it was a brutal thing, but it had come to this. I'll say this. I think we say this right. You know, God is not punishing these people. They're being punished by God for violating what he said to do, right? I mean, if you're a teacher and I asked you, how many students did you fail? You'd probably say, I didn't fail any of them. They got the grade they earned, right? And I think sometimes we misappropriate. That's how people like to paint God. Look at this terrible thing God has done. How dare he this? How dare he that? That's not what's happening here. He was very clear about what was going to happen, right? And he didn't want any compromise either. It wasn't enough. See, the days of this are over. The days of Jeroboam, and we're going to see it more, but God's done no more compromise. It's not good enough to say, well, I still worship you as Yahweh, but I acknowledge these other gods exist. Nope, that's not enough. Okay, well, I worship you as Yahweh, but we're going to do it through a cow. That's not enough, right? God has had it, and it takes centuries, right? That's what this all leads up to, right? It's all about Christ. Understanding God's sense of justice is hard because, again, we don't want justice for the most part. We want mercy. But understanding God's justice is what we see here, and we see it delivered.
David said justice and judgment is the foundation of this throne.
Yep, that's right. Any other comments on that?
Like you say, the people suffered through all this in some ways, but they were already so abused, and it was the leadership again. Yeah. Not the scribes and Pharisees yet, but it was the people who should have been God's shepherds and leaders. So they were the ones that he took down.
He does. And you notice that's when Jesus takes action too. Again, we've talked about this before. When Jesus gets really mad, who's it against? It's against the religious, right? Those who should know better. That's the message, right? He has no tolerance for that, right? So a few closing thoughts. I won't go through all the things to mention, but I want to mention a few, and I'm going to skip through a few things. By the way, I did want to put this up because I couldn't help it. That's an Iron Age toilet. The latrine, and it mentions in, if you read 2 Kings 10 here, it talks about Jehu going to great pains to, after they do all this, they kill the prophets, they tear down Asherah's stuff, and they build a latrine in there. And you see that throughout. Hezekiah does it. A lot of cultures did that back and forth to say, oh, we're going to let the building stay. And I just read an excavation the other day where it was near Samaria where there was one like this, and it was like the horned, like the cow thing. They broke off the horns. They found it shoved inside the toilet. And so these people, you know, the Bible's not G-rated per se, right? But it's, you know, these people were clear. That's a sense of justice. We just mentioned all this, but I wanted to close with what we see happen. We see Jehu go through his vengeance tour, and at the very end, if you follow this through, it doesn't work out, right? Even Jehu, after so many years, begins to compromise. He begins to compromise politically and religiously. And Hazael comes back in later, and I put this up several times the last 3 weeks on purpose because I didn't show you the other side of it yet. The obelisk of Shalmaneser is one of the biggest things we know of. All the sides tell us the stories of Omri and Ahab having victories. It talks about Shalmaneser having some. It talks about Hazael of Damascus, if you want to read those, and all of his conquests. But we see 2 Kings close with it literally says in verse 32, God began to reduce the size of Israel. He began to take it apart. And we see Israel now be taken apart, right? And I wanted to show the other side here because what we don't see is mighty Jehu. We have this is Jehu of Israel, who his final image we have of him on this obelisk is of him giving tribute to Shalmaneser, the Assyrians, if they come in. All this stuff to be brought so low, right? And what's left of this king, you know, we see him and his successors are left as nothing but groveling because they too fell from God, right? That's all the time we have. So we'll pick up with another topic next week. Thank you all.